Thank you for taking the time to listen to this life-changing message from the Ministry of Faith Bible Chapel. We hope this message will encourage you in all parts of your life. At the end of this message, you will hear more information on how to contact our church family, as well as directions for you to visit us for any of our worship services. Until then, join us for the service in progress.
I know what some of you are thinking. It's right on the edge of spring slash summer, and I'm up here talking to you again, and there's probably many of you are going, man, Dave Runyon's going to come, and he's going to do that whole thing with the Great Commandment and then make me feel horrible because I don't even know the names of my neighbors, and he keeps doing this year after year, and I can't take 35 more minutes of listening to this guy talk about something that's so simple as knowing your neighbor and throwing good parties. Anyone? Am I nailing it for anybody in here? A few nods? Okay. All right. Well, I got good news. We're not going to do that today. We still, as you heard from that email from Vicky Ryer, we still believe that the best thing that we can do together in our city is this idea of encouraging people to take the Great Commandment literally. And the one thing that we've learned over the last 4 years is that when Christians learn and retain the names of their neighbors, and when Christians are a part of throwing great parties, that really good things happen. And so we're not taking our foot off the accelerator in any way, shape, or form, but as just a sign of our confidence in your intelligence, we thought that maybe we could go a year, we think maybe you got it, and that you're gonna keep doing it, and we're gonna try to bribe you and give away a grill and all kinds of wonderful stuff to do that. So today we're gonna shift gears, and all over the city, you know, 20-something churches, as I'm driving through today, and just like, this is a big day. This isn't normal that 20-something churches are all going to unpack the exact same text and to really look and to start to dream about how is it that we, the people of God, are called to invest in the cities that we reside in. And as Pastor George mentioned, something very unique is happening among the churches in our area. And we've talked about it a lot, and you hear people come up, and we pray for each other, and we pray for the school. There's just a lot of really incredible things going on, and so it's easy to start thinking that's the norm, and it's not. And we want it to be. We want someday, that is the dream, is that the norm is that in our cities, in our countries, that people of God will be known for the way that they work together. And 7 years ago for us, this started with a group of pastors sitting in a room, dreaming about how we could be the body. And the text that inspired all of our initial conversations was John 17. It was Jesus' prayer for unity. Jesus prays, may all the believers that lived at that time and all the believers in the future be one. Because when there is unity, he says, that people that don't know God in this mystical, magical, beautiful way are sucked towards God. And so as we as pastors and faith leaders start to think about that passage and dream about what it would look like to put it into action, we started to meet with different civic leaders and to hear their heart and hear what would they do if they could mobilize the best volunteer army in our cities and in our communities. And we kept asking this question, what is it that we could do together that we could never do alone? And what has happened over the past few years has surpassed our wildest dreams. As we mentioned, there's over 80,000 people have been mobilized now by the neighboring initiative. Just as importantly, there are a number of different networks just like ours. So all over our city, in places like Lakewood and Aurora and Edgewater and Littleton, there's these networks, just like the one we have here in Arvada, that are starting to pop up. And we're all starting to get together and dream about what would it look like if Denver could become known as a place where people of faith, where churches and kingdom-minded people work together. And so that's our dream. And we believe that it's starting to happen. So this is a big day, and I'm glad that you're here and that you're able to partake in this moment with a lot of other people that aren't even in this room. So I want to say this as a side note. We talk a lot when we start to talk about City Unite and what's happening in our city. We talk a lot about Arvada because Arvada is the city where God has placed this church. And so we build a lot of bridges to the mayor and to the city manager and to the police department. And there's a good chance that you don't live in Arvada, right? There's a lot of you out in this room that you don't live in Arvada. And you may start thinking to yourself, why do they just keep talking about Arvada over and over and over again? And I want to encourage you, as we spend some time in the text today, I want you to think about your city that you live in. I want you to think about the community that you live in, because you, this isn't a big newsflash, you live somewhere. You do live somewhere, right? And And where you live really does matter. The Bible is very clear that you have been placed where you are for a reason. Acts 17 says, it says, He, God, made the earth from one man, every nation of mankind, to live on the face of the earth. And He has marked out our appointed times in history and the boundaries of our dwelling places. And so there's this principle all throughout the Old and the New Testament called a theology of place. It's this idea that God has placed you where you are, that what surrounds you matters. And in our culture, with how fast-paced and transient everything is, that many of us as Christians have lost, and we have a weak understanding of what it means to have a theology of place. And fortunately for us, the Bible has a lot to say about this, and the story of Nehemiah in particular provides us with a blueprint for how we're called to interact in the neighborhoods, the communities, and the cities that we've been placed in. So if you have your Bible, you can open it up to Nehemiah chapter 1. If you don't have your Bible, we'll put it all up on the screen there for you. Nehemiah is it's right between Ezra and Esther in the Old Testament. It's an incredible book. And we're just going to kind of take a thumbnail sketch of this book here today, the first couple chapters. But I would encourage you, if you're looking for a place to land in Scripture to begin to maybe have some of your quiet times each day, I would encourage you to look at Nehemiah. It's a fascinating story. So as you're turning there, I'm going to give you a little background on what's happening at this time in the history of the Israelites. The glory days of King David and King Solomon are long gone by the time we get to Nehemiah. And some of you know that the history of the Jewish people is that after King Solomon, many of the people begin to drift away from God to worship other idols. And many, many people, God uses a lot of different voices to come and to warn the Israelites and to say, if you do not turn back, you are going to be given over. Your place, your land is going to be taken. You are going to get defeated. And in 587 BC, after a number of warnings, the Babylonian army comes in and they just wipe out Judah and Jerusalem. They destroy the temple and they take the majority of the Jews, the people, and they take them 800 miles back to what is modern day Iraq, Iran. And they are held as captives. And that exile, that lasts for 70 years. And then the Persian Empire comes, and they overthrow the Babylonians. And they have a different approach with how they interact with the Jews. They actually start to let many of them go back. They're still, quote-unquote, captives. They're still underneath Persian rule. But they're allowed to go back. And so many of the Jews start to go back to Jerusalem. And so at the time of Nehemiah, we have a remnant, we have a group of Jews who are living back in Jerusalem, and yet at the same time, we still have a group that are living there in Babylon. And there's 800 miles between these two groups of people. So let's pick it up in chapter 1, verse 2. This is Nehemiah telling his story. Hananiah, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men. And I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province, are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. So this book opens, and we see that Nehemiah's brother has come to visit him from Jerusalem. And the first thing Nehemiah does is he says, tell me about the condition of the city. And when Nehemiah hears that it is in ruins, he's overwhelmed with grief. Nehemiah identifies with the brokenness and the pain in his community in a very profound way. And we are told he cries, he weeps for days when he comes face to face with the scorecard, the report card of what's happening in his home city. Now, later on, we're going to learn that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. Okay, now here's the job description for the cupbearer. His job is to drink all of the wine that the king is going to drink before the king and eat all of the food so that if somebody has poisoned it, that he will die instead of the king. Okay, now, there's a small chance that Nehemiah's job might be detrimental to his health. Okay, it's a chance. If it doesn't happen, though, I want you to think about what his life is like. This is a guy who lives in the king's palace, who gets to consume everything that the king gets to consume, but doesn't have to have any of the weight of the responsibility of leading as the king does. And I'm trying to think of a modern day example of this, and all I can think of is like what it would be like if you were part of Justin Bieber's entourage, okay? So you don't have any, you have to do any like the performer or anything like that, but our entourage of anybody who's famous, right? These people just kind of ride around and they get to experience all the spoils of the success without the responsibility. Like Nehemiah's job, his role, he's got a pretty cush job. And he's 800 miles away from his hometown. How easy would it have been for Nehemiah to hear about the city, or to not even ask, or not even want to know about the condition of his city, and to just kind of keep that all in the back of his mind, and then to just live and continue on in his very comfortable, quaint, spoiled life. And it's so fascinating that that's not what Nehemiah chooses to do. Instead, Nehemiah is filled with compassion. His heart breaks. He's so overwhelmed that all he can do is just sit down and cry. Nehemiah knows that things in his city, in his community, are not the way that God wants them to be, and it actually crushes him. And as we will see, because he identifies with the brokenness of the city, he's compelled to actually do something about it. Let's pick it up in verse 5. Then I said, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps the covenant of love with those whom love him and keep his commandments. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes be open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws that you gave your servant Moses. Then he goes on to say this, verse 11, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man, of the king. We see that Nehemiah is overwhelmed with emotion and compassion about the brokenness that exists in his community, and he responds by praying. He prays from the heart, he prays for the people, and he prays for the city as a whole, and he prays this prayer of confession. He acknowledges that he and his people have neglected the commands that God has given them. You know, when we come face to face with a lot of the brokenness and pain in our world, that this is the only way to respond, is by going to God. There's nothing, when you actually begin to feel the weight of the way things are, it drives us towards God in prayer. And in verse 11, we see that he also prays for favor. He prays that God, that the people who God has put in authority will help him as he sets out to change things. And this is really incredible. As I was reading Nehemiah's prayer, I was reminded of a verse in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is writing to the people in Babylon during the Babylonian captivity. And the Babylonians literally go into Jerusalem. They take most of the people out and they bring them back to Babylon and they try to whitewash them. They try to brainwash all of their culture and their customs out of the Jewish people. This is an evil empire. And yet, look what Jeremiah says to the Jews. This is what he tells to the people of Babylon. Jeremiah 29:7, he says this. He says, seek the peace and the prosperity of the city. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. That doesn't make any sense. What? I'm supposed to actually seek the peace and the prosperity of Babylon? I know that I'm supposed to do that with Jerusalem. You know, God's relationship with Jerusalem is special, and the dream of Jerusalem becoming the city that reflects God's glory to the rest of the world. But you know what? It's not... Yes, that is special, that is incredible, it's amazing, but it's not just Jerusalem. Now here we have in Babylon, he's telling his people, he says, pray for the peace and the prosperity of the city, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Simply put, we have been called as individuals and as a church community to pray for the cities that we reside in, to seek the prosperity of it, wherever we are. And, you know, it's tempting. When you look at what's going on out there in the world, it's tempting to just go, oh, my goodness, I'm going to just start praying that, like, some miracle happens and that everybody who's, like, in a position of influence is just wiped off the face of the earth and we just start all over. Right? Let's just go huddle up. Let's get inside this place. It is terrifying out there. That's not the posture that God tells his people to have. He's saying, pray for it. Pray for these people that I have put into positions of authority. Seek the peace and the prosperity of the city. Lasting change always starts with prayer. Prayer was essential to Nehemiah's preparation. And he comes to God with this understanding of how little he can do on his own and the fact that, God is the one who's in control. Now, let's skip over to chapter 2. We'll pick it up here in verse 4 and 5. The king said to me, so Nehemiah decides, I'm going to go to the king, to my boss, and I'm going to ask him for these things. Yeah, and he has a big ask here. He says this, the king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the Lord, to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. Verses 7, I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have the letters to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me with safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall for the residence that I will occupy? Nehemiah goes to the king and says, hey, can you give me permission to go? Can I get a lot of resources? And can I have all your relational equity, for protection? And God opens up the king's heart. The king says, yes. So Nehemiah, he grieves the condition of the city. He prays, and then he turns his attention towards restoring the walls of the city itself. And at this time, the walls of a city are important in a level of status and in a really practical way. See, the wall, literally, if you had a city at this point in time, if you did not have walls, intact walls around your city, people would just come through and rape and pillage your community. And there were just roving bands of pirates that would do this on a regular basis. And so when you looked at a city, you kind of judged the health of a city, the first thing that you looked at were the walls. And that's why when Nehemiah hears about the condition that they're in ruins, it breaks him. It touches off something significant inside of him. In Nehemiah, he has this, what I would like to call a Popeye moment. Okay, now, I barely remember Popeye. So if you're younger than me, this is going to pass you. But a lot of you in this room are going to be able to help me out. I want you to do this with me. Remember this saying? Popeye would say, that's all I can stand, and I can't stand no more, right? I can't stand no more. When Nehemiah comes face to face with what's going on in his community, he has this Popeye moment where he just goes, that's it. I can't stand no more. And he doesn't just say, man, that's horrible. I bet somebody else out there is doing it. Somebody else out there is probably doing it. No, he gets really present to what's going on, and it turns into action. Nehemiah sees himself and sees his role in his community as somebody who restores the things that are broken. And in verse 4 and 5, we see that Nehemiah values working with others. It's interesting to note that Nehemiah's first action step is to partner with a king of a foreign country, a civic leader who God has put in authority, who does not have the same faith framework that he has. And he approaches the king. He humbly asks him for resources, for relational equity, for protection. The king grants it to him. And then shortly after, Nehemiah makes this 800-mile, three-month journey back to the city of Jerusalem. And it's very interesting to see how he interacts with the city, what his posture is like when he gets there. So let's pick it up again in chapter 2, verse 15. This is Nehemiah again talking. It says, so I went up to the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in? Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about how the gracious hand of my God on me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. In verse 16, we learn that when he finally arrives to the city, he brings together the nobles, the other officials, the blue-collar workers, and he brings them all together who are going to be doing this work. And I think that when you see how he does this, I mean, we can learn a lot as how we as Christians can interact here today and in our culture. Because Nehemiah doesn't go in there with trumpets blazing saying, I'm here to save the city. He comes in and he begins to go out and to look at the walls. And he observes firsthand the broken areas of his community. And then he calls together this diverse group of people to set about the task of rebuilding and restoring the city. And the next six chapters, all the way through chapter 8, detail the story of this successful physical rebuilding of the city walls and of the city itself. And it wasn't easy. They faced a lot of opposition along the way. But however, by working with likely and unlikely partners, we learn that they're able to rebuild the city walls in just 52 days. And the task that they accomplished was so amazing where all these other people start looking around and they're astounded. We're told that they're astounded at what had been done in such a short amount of time. And then the second half of Nehemiah goes on to tell the story of the spiritual renewal of the people in the city. It's a cool story, right? But I think when we encounter the text, it's important for us to ask, how does this intersect with my life right now, right here, today? And in order to do that, I think I want to ask you to reflect on three questions. First, are you aware of the brokenness in our community? Are you allowing yourself to really identify with it? When you watch the news, you read about it online, it's really tempting to just turn it off. There's so many stories that are depressing that a lot of us have just learned how to live out of a mental framework in which we can just segment that and not allow it to actually touch our hearts or our lives. And the scary thing about that is that that's not how God has asked us to live. A crucial step to living the kind of life that God intended us to live is that we actually, like Nehemiah, allow ourselves to experience compassion and empathy for the people that are hurting in our world and the ones that are hurting right in our backyard. And we all have this tendency to protect ourselves from the ruins. It's tempting to ignore what's really happening. How many of you, when you turned on the TV last week and you saw what had happened in Moore, Oklahoma, found yourself with just a way to kind of segment that out, to not allow it to actually touch your life, your heart, to not really be present to it? It's real, real easy to do. And to say, oh, somebody's going to do something about that. In order to be the kind of people that God has called us to be, we have to have the courage to be aware of what's happening all around us. Are you aware that the number of homeless families in our community has over doubled in the last 3 years? The Denver Post ran an article on the suburban homeless 2 years ago and mentioned the fact that there are more homeless students at Arvada High School than at any school in the Denver public school system. And they're sleeping on couches and in hotels. Do you know that in Arvada we have an unusually high number of child abuse cases that compared to all the other cities around us, that for some reason in our city, that number is skewed way up. Do you know that 61% of 20-somethings are just nationwide just putting their faith on the shelf right now? That the issue here in Arvada of isolated elderly shut-ins is growing at a really rapid rate, and if something doesn't change drastically in 5 to 7 years, that we're going to have a real problem on our hands. That over 1,000 kids in Arvada, 1,000 kids in Arvada, would go hungry without the aid of a food program inside of a school, and that we're getting ready to come up to a time in the summer where a lot of those programs, a lot of those kids and families don't have access to it. So these are things that are really hard for us to think about and to identify with. But it's exactly what God has called us, has called his people to do. And when we do slow down our life enough, when we do unplug enough to get present to what's really happening, the next question I think we have to ask is this: are we regularly praying for the city that God has placed us in? Because when we allow ourselves to identify, some of you are feeling some of that right now, when you allow yourself to get present to the pain and to the suffering that exists right here in our community, like Nehemiah, inevitably, it's so easy to become overwhelmed. And when this happens, the next step, the only response, is for us to turn to God. Prayer is a crucial part of Nehemiah's journey, part of his preparation, and it should be a crucial part of our journey, our preparation. You know, do you pray for the kids in our community that are going hungry? For the elderly person that's next door to you? For the growing number of homeless families that are all around us? For the people that are living on the margins? For the leaders that God has put in positions of authority in your community? I mean, if you only do one thing walking out here today, that I would say that, do it. Just do that. Just commit to praying. Not these vague, general, whitewashed prayers. Like, pray for, like, real people, for real issues that are happening right around us. You know, the first Friday of every month, there's a group of people that meet in the Faith Prayer Chapel just to pray for our city and for our county. 8 a.m. if you want to show up. Or just take time in your own schedule to say, you know what, open up the newspaper. Go online on your tablet, whatever it is, and as you read those, just pray. Just pray for our city. Finally, it's interesting to note that Nehemiah does pray for favor. And here's the great news for us here in our city. The doors are wide open because of what's happened with some of the school partnerships and the neighboring movement. Doors are open for us, for you, for the believers in our city that we could have never dreamed about 10 years ago. God has given us an incredible amount of favor. Last month, I had a police commander call us, our group, and said, hey, when can I meet with you next? I'm dreaming about what it looks like to mobilize the people that are sitting in your pews for the betterment of our city. They're actually calling us. And so with that comes a responsibility that we steward that, and that we are faithful with what God has given us. So the last question I'd have you ask is this: is, are you working with others to address the needs of those who live around you? And, you know, I think I looked through the Old and the New Testament, and one of the primary themes throughout both of those is that God has a huge heart for the poor, and God has a huge heart for people in need. And you cannot read very long in either one of those and not run up against that. And not only does God have a huge heart for the poor and for those in need, but that God has called us as believers to stand in the middle of the way things are and the way things are supposed to be, right? I mean, you go through over and over and over again, and just a few of my favorites in Isaiah 58, the Israelites are looking and they're crying out to God saying, why aren't you listening to our prayers? Why aren't you with us? We're doing all these things. We're doing all these rituals and fasting. We're jumping through all these religious hoops. And God says, that's not what I want. That's not real religion. That's not real worship. Worship is when you go and you spend yourselves on the behalf of the oppressed and those in need. In James, in chapter 1, it says, true religion is when we care for the orphan, for the widows. In Matthew 25, the parable of the sheep and the goats should be to you the most terrifying text in the Bible. And you got to put it in context, but literally all it says, listen, the people who are going to enter the kingdom are the ones who take care of those who need clothes, who need food, who visit the prisoners. And those who are not going to enter the kingdom are the people who don't do that. Like, God is really serious when it comes to our responsibility to be a redemptive force in our community and in our world. And I think it's worth noting that throughout the Bible and throughout history, God's people and the gospel is at its best when they are both proclaiming and demonstrating the gospel. Throughout history, if you just look, it's always at its best. It's always at its healthiest when there's the proclamation and the demonstration of the gospel. I mean, when Jesus is going around and he's healing people and performing those miracles, what he's doing there is he's showing people, he's giving them glimpses of the kingdom. He's saying, listen, you know, to the blind person, this is not the way it's supposed to be. And he's healing this person. He's restoring to what it's going to be someday. And we're called to do that. I lived a lot of my life thinking like the whole end game was just to like say a prayer and raise your hand and then just sit around and grind out the rest of your life till you die and go to heaven. That sounds horrible, right? Here's the great news. That first step is huge. It's huge. But then God has invited us to orient our lives around the way that Jesus says to live. That there's a whole new way that we reorient our lives, and it's central to that way of living is that we go and that we see ourselves as restorers of what is broken. That we're a redemptive force in our cities and in our communities. You know, the greatest period of growth in the history of the Christian movement happens in the first 300 years. And so I think it's interesting to go back and look and it's not even close. If you can just look at the growth of Christianity, those first three, nothing, there's never been a time period that's come anywhere close to that. And so it's interesting to go back and look at what was going on in history at that time. And there's a lot of factors, but one of the things that's very interesting is that twice from the time of Christ until the year 300 AD, twice there are two epidemics, there are two plagues that come and just decimate that area of the world. One happens in 154 AD, the other one happens in 251 AD. In Rome, there are estimates between 4,000 or 5,000 people a day were dying. And people didn't understand how disease worked. All of these things, things would just spread. There's a lot of different factors of why both of these plagues and epidemics spread across the region in such a quick way. But both times, about a fourth of the population is lost. And then you go back and you start to actually look at what are the Christians up to during this time? And this is so interesting. A bishop in his Easter sermon in 260 after the second plague is talking to his people about this very thing, about what's happening. All this growth in the movement has been happening. And here's what he says. He says, he's talking about during both of these epidemics. It says, most of our Christian brothers showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves. They took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ. Many, in nursing and curing others, transferred their death to themselves and died in their stead. He goes on to say this. The pagans behaved in the very opposite way. At the first onset of disease, they pushed sufferers out of the way and fled from their dearest, throwing them into the roads before they were dead, hoping to avert the spread of a fatal disease. So just put yourself in one of these cities. And so the disease would come in, and because they had no idea anyone who was affluent or a leader or even the physicians would just flee the city, leaving their family members, anyone who even had a glimpse of sickness, leaving them in the road to die. And the Christians, because they take the text so seriously, the Christians would go into the city. They would go into these places where the disease was starting to spread and begin to care for, and many of the Christians died. But guess what happens? Put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's been left for dead and who actually makes it through. What would you think about these people and their God who came in and engaged in that and walked alongside of you? And what we see is there is this massive, massive revival where people are coming to know Jesus. People are coming to know God all over the place because the radical love and care of the people of God. You know, the story of Nehemiah, it's about a person who allows himself to get present to the brokenness of his community, who works with others to restore the physical condition of his community, his city. And as a result, the people turn their attention to God. It's the model of how we are called to live. And the great news, this is doable. And I think that over time, because of how overwhelming the problems are, I think a lot of the power that we as believers are supposed to have, that radical care and love, has been watered down. And there's a lot of you in this room that are part of some amazing things. But as a whole, when we look at the face of, in kind of the reputation of Christianity in our country, I mean, are we known more for what we're against or what we're for? It seems like to me that like the times where revival was happening, it was the times where Christians were known what they were for. And it's clear from Nehemiah and all throughout the Bible that we cannot accomplish the task that God has put before us on our own. And I love the fact that pastors in our city are getting together and we have this network and we're becoming friends together and dreaming about the city. I love that. But that's not the end game. And if it ends there with a bunch of pastors sitting in a room doing a joint sermon once a year, I think God would be really sad. Because the big dream, what God really wants, is for us, all of us, to be linking arms, to be partnering up with others, to be seeing the church as the big C church, and to be working together to restore what is broken. And Faith has been a leader in this city for a long time when it comes to what's going on around the world. And here's the great news. We don't have to go to the other side of the world. If we're willing to slow down and to get present to what's actually happening, there are opportunities all around us. All around us. And so I'm excited about what God's doing in our city. But what I'm really excited about is what could be. I'm really excited about what is it, because the next step is moving from coming and doing a sermon once a year together to the Christians in our city starting to believe at a deep and personal level that they were created for something more, and bring them to dream and to pray, to have some of those Popeye moments, right? What is it that you can't stand? What is it? I think when we begin to answer that question and we begin to find others who are passionate about some of those things, that some really great things can happen. What would happen in our city, in our community, if the 20,000 people that are hearing this message today all began to make a commitment to say, I'm going to get present. I'm going to identify with what's really happening. I'm going to pray regularly for our city. I'm going to look for opportunities to work with others in order to be a redemptive force in our community. And I'd just like to end today just by inviting you to take a few minutes to just reflect on that. What is it? What's that next step that God is calling you to take? What's that next breadcrumb that you're supposed to go and follow? And maybe in just next couple of minutes, we just create a time where God could really just speak to you and to put on your heart whatever he has in store for you.
You're the God of this city. You're the King of these people. You're the Lord of this nation. You are. You're the light in this darkness. You're the hope to the hopeless. You're the peace to the restless. You are. There is no one like our God. There is no one like our God. The greater things have yet to come, and greater things are still to be done in this city. Greater things have yet to come, and greater things are still to be done in this city. Greater things have yet to come, and greater things are still to be done. We believe in you, God. Greater things have yet to come, and greater things are still to be done in this city. For greater things have yet to come, and greater things are still to be done here.
You know, I think it's easy sometimes for us to get tricked into thinking that there's 70, 80 different churches here in our city. I think, you know, when Paul writes to the church in Rome, there's congregations all over Rome. When he writes to the church in Corinth, the church in Ephesus. But that's not what it says. It says to the church. You know, when God looks down on us, he looks at us through the filter of the church in our city. And so I'm really excited about what God has been doing to awaken in all of us, just kind of a passion to be the church of Arvada, to be the church of the community that he's put us in. And it's going to be fun to watch what happens over the next few years.
We hope that this message has spoken something personal to you. If you would like more information about our church family or service times, please call us at 303-424-2121 or visit us at our website, www.fbci.org. Faith Bible Chapel currently meets in our Family Worship Center, located on the corner of 62nd Avenue and Ward Road.